Lake Erie has been hacked. But don't worry, that's a good thing.
Techies, entrepreneurs, coders, businesses, engineers, and environmentalists put their talents to work for our most precious natural resource.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, we go inside a hackathon for cleaner water. Plus, what's behind the backlash against plastic bag bans?
We've got really used to our conveniences, and it's hard to switch from that, but we did exist before those things too, so I think we'll be okay. Hopefully.
And public lands might not be so public under the Trump administration. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. While delegates from 195 countries are working out details of the Paris Climate Agreement in Bonn, Germany this week, the White House delayed a much-anticipated announcement about the U.S.'s future commitment to the agreement. Some news outlets are reporting President Trump's advisors are giving him conflicting advice about whether the U.S. should withdraw. But that's happening behind closed doors. Deliberations that were a little more public, but still not well publicized, took place in late March at a hearing on climate science and policy held by the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. Michael Mann, a climate researcher and author from Penn State University, was a witness. And the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier recently talked to him about it.
Okay, so you testified before the House Committee on Science. Why did you want to testify before this committee?
Well, I was asked actually by the Democrats to testify. There were three other witnesses all invited by the Republicans. And the witnesses I would characterize as being individuals who are in the fairly small fringe of the scientific community who deny or downplay the reality and impacts of climate change. So I was sort of the sole voice of the scientific consensus. That means one out of the four witnesses who testified was really part of the scientific consensus, which is ironic given that most studies that have looked at the scientific literature have concluded that somewhere between 97 and 99% of actual scientists publishing in the scientific literature are convinced by the evidence that climate change is real, human-caused, and a problem. In this hearing, only 25% of the witnesses reflected that position. Me.
Anybody else want to add any comments? Dr. Mann?
Yeah, so we have widespread measurements now from satellites, direct measurements of the total ice mass contained in the ice sheets. And there is no question that the two main potential contributors to global sea level rise, the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet, are losing ice. And we know that that loss of ice means that the ice sheets are contributing to sea level rise already. Now, we hear so much about uncertainty, as if uncertainty is a reason for inaction. But in this case, the uncertainties are breaking against us because we are actually seeing more rapid loss of ice from those ice sheets than the climate models that many here criticize had predicted in the past.
Dr. Mann, Dr. Curry, thank you. Dr. Christie, next time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks.
I'd like to play a little tape from Chairman Smith's testimony and then get your reaction.
Alarmist predictions amount to nothing more than wild guesses. The ability to predict far into the future is impossible. Anyone stating they know what the climate will be in 500 years or even at the end of the century is not credible.
Okay, so you just heard Lamar Smith, House member from Texas. But I mean, I think you hear a lot of that kind of rhetoric from folks who are on this side that climate change isn't sort of a settled scientific phenomena, and that we shouldn't be basing our policies on unsettled scientific theories at this point. What's your reaction when you hear that kind of talk?
Well, it's really troubling. And, you know, we hear the same arguments from the critics of the theory of evolution who want, you know, creationism taught in schools because they're convinced that there isn't a scientific consensus there either. And it's not coincidental that where you find this sort of opposition to the overwhelming consensus of the world's scientists is whenever an issue happens to touch on ideological or religious matters or when it involves an issue that impacts one of the most powerful and wealthiest industries on the face of the earth, the fossil fuel industry. Now, what you often hear from these critics, and they're not skeptics, because good scientists actually are skeptics. All good scientists are skeptical, and you need evidence and logical reasoning and compelling arguments to support a hypothesis or finding. And that's what Carl Sagan referred to as the self-correcting machinery that helps keep science on the path towards a better understanding of the way our world and our universe works. It's that intrinsic skepticism of demanding the most evidence for those propositions that are most extraordinary. And here, you know, to deny that the Earth is warming, that the human impact of increasing greenhouse gas concentrations from fossil fuels is behind that, or to deny the impacts that we are now plainly seeing of climate change in terms of unprecedented droughts and floods and extreme weather events, to deny that is extraordinary. And yet, those who do deny the overwhelming evidence can't marshal any convincing lines of evidence for their case. That's the opposite of skepticism. That's contrarianism or denialism.
Huge, you know, scientific organizations all basically endorse the view that carbon dioxide is responsible, that we've created is responsible for the vast majority of recent global warming. And yet the American populace is not entirely behind that. I just read a recent Pew poll that found that only 48% of Americans are, you know, agree with that statement that people are responsible for climate change. Why is this the case? Why is it so hard for scientists to get through to regular people that this is happening and it's because of us?
There's been a massive campaign to confuse the public and policymakers about the science. In fact, back in 2002, there was a memo that was leaked into the public domain. It was from Republican pollster Frank Luntz. And he noted that the public was becoming convinced of the scientific evidence. And if they became convinced that there was consensus among the world scientists, they would demand policy action be taken. But what he said is, based on his focus groups and his polling, there was still time to insert doubt into the public discourse. And he encouraged fossil fuel interest to fund talking heads and front groups and support the campaigns of politicians who were willing to confuse the public about this problem. If it sounds familiar, it's because it's exactly what the tobacco industry did decades ago. In fact, it's called the tobacco strategy, the idea that when the findings of science prove inconvenient to powerful special interests, be it the tobacco industry or the fossil fuel industry, one way, unfortunately, for those interests to try to gain a foothold is to simply muddy the conversation. As long as the public thinks there's a scientific debate, they won't demand action be taken.
Michael Mann is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University, and his most recent book is called The Madhouse Effect: How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier interviewed Mann, and there's a lot more to hear at our website, alleghenyfront.org. This is The Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. Public lands can be national parks, forests, or protected areas like the ones designated as national monuments. One professor from Montana says just because many of these majestic mountains and vistas are out west, it doesn't mean they don't belong to all of us.
These lands are of national significance. Glacier, Yellowstone, some of our crown jewels, our wilderness areas.
Later on the Allegheny Front, what's at stake if the boundaries of the nation's public lands shift under the Trump administration? Stay tuned. When we hear about hacking, it's usually not a good news story. But to improve water quality in Lake Erie, teams of engineers, software developers, and students have been working for months on a hacking competition. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant was there as the winners were announced and has this story.
So how do you get the best young minds onto a project? The Cleveland Water Alliance offered up cash and support and put out a call around the Great Lakes region for the Erie hack. And the ideas started flowing.
Four states, two countries, pulling together over 45 teams of techies, entrepreneurs, coders, businesses, engineers, and environmentalists to put their talents to work collectively and individually for our most precious natural resource.
That's Cleveland meteorologist Betsy Kling. She emceed as the final nine teams pitched their ideas to a panel of judges. Think a little bit the TV show Shark Tank and a lot toxic algae and beach monitoring. It was a personal project for Lewis Lane, a one-man team from Toledo, who laid out a scenario for the judges.
Imagine receiving a phone call at 6 o'clock in the morning from your spouse and being told that there are toxins in the lake preventing anyone from actually using the water. Now imagine actually having to use bottled water to brush your teeth, to wash dishes, having to use bottled water to bathe your six-month-old child.
Lane remembers when this happened in 2014. He was among a 500,000 people in Ohio and Michigan who were told not to use their tap water. Toxic cyanobacteria in western Lake Erie had clogged water treatment systems. The recurring algae problem is an impetus for this contest.
Because local governments are actually spending millions of dollars each year trying to prevent this thing. And I'm actually here today because I never want to feel as helpless as I did the day I received that first phone call.
Lane pitched a floating drone. It would monitor the lake for cyanobacteria, collect data, and could even inject good algae into the water. Agencies like the Great Lakes Commission, which is tasked with protecting the region's economic and environmental health, say they need more data about what's actually going on in the water to make decisions about what to do. Enter the Water Warriors. That's a team from the University of Akron. They've already started using young students to collect data about pollution in the lake, arming them with spectrometers that detect nitrogen and phosphorus.
And by the way, this data is robust enough that it can be used to back up policy decisions.
Many schools around the Great Lakes and elsewhere are lining up for their technology.
Schools and educators have been priced out of the market until now. Our functioning prototype costs less than $20 to make. And with your $40,000, we're aiming to get 250 spectrometers immediately into the hands of our Northeast Ohio school teachers and kids.
One team from the University of Michigan went a different route. They pitched a mobile app that would allow individuals to track their own water usage and earn rewards for decreasing consumption. Another team pitched an acoustic underwater communication system. And then there was MicroBuoy, a team of PhD students from Wayne State University in Detroit. They want to speed up the process of getting water sample results.
So this is kind of how it works right now. We manually take water samples, we transport them to a lab, and we wait 24 to 48 hours for the results.
This team thinks that's too long, especially when it comes to beach monitoring and deciding if the water is safe for swimming. That's one reason they created a nanosensor contained inside a buoy. It can continuously measure for environmental contaminants in the water and send the results out in real time. And what really got the judges' interest was their really tiny battery.
And you said it was rechargeable with the solar panels?
This battery is rechargeable, yeah.
With the solar panels?
With the solar panels.
Those batteries and sensors are even small enough to fit inside a home faucet and test for lead and other contaminants. After the nine team presentations, the judges deliberated. It was exciting and a little nerve-wracking for some of the teams. And then...
finally, the grand prize winners for Erie Hack 2017 with $40,000 cash and $10,000 in kind, MicroBuoy.
The team that developed those nanosensors and batteries hopped on stage to receive an oversized check and smile for photos.
Beers are on him.
And the contest organizers, they've already announced another water hacking competition for this fall. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Here's a problem in the Great Lakes that could use some hacking. Plastic bags. They're a persistent litter problem along the shore and in the water. Of course, plastic bags are seen as a nuisance all over the country. Some cities, like New York, have tried to ban bags or charge a fee for them. But as Veronica Volk of Great Lakes Today tells us, it's hard to make these bans stick.
There's a tiny beach at Erie Basin Marina in Buffalo, New York. It looks out over Lake Erie, and Nate Drag with the Alliance for the Great Lakes says it's one of his favorite spots. The beach is only a few yards across, but it's loaded with debris. Some natural, like driftwood, some not so much.
The closer you look, I mean, you can start seeing the plastic popping out.
Part of Drag's job at the Alliance for the Great Lakes is to organize beach cleanups. Last year, he says, hundreds of volunteers picked up thousands of pounds of trash. Among them, plastic bags.
So, okay, there you go. There's your garbage bag, and then there's the shopping bag.
The Alliance is one of many organizations advocating for reduced use of plastic bags. Back in his office, Drag explains that the same things that make plastic bags so great for us make them so bad for the ecosystem.
You know, the fact that they are relatively strong means they will last a long time, and they're very light, so they will blow in the breeze and move far, and they'll move in the water.
Plastic bag bans have been gaining popularity since San Francisco became the first major American city to ban them outright in 2007. Since then, other coastal and Great Lakes communities have proposed similar laws, including small fees for using them at the checkout. Some companies even enforce their own bag rules. Michaela Coltrera is the community relations supervisor for Hart's Grocer in Rochester, New York. She says they offer 10-cent credits to customers with reusable bags.
Well, anytime you're using a reusable bag, you're not wasting and you're not creating more waste for the environment. And that's something that we've always been, has always been part of a mission.
But not everyone is moved to change. Opponents of bag bans say fees disproportionately impact poorer shoppers. Others say reusable and paper bags are rough on the ecosystem, too. And some companies argue that it's inefficient to have regulations vary from city to city. But the main argument, Drag says, is people just don't like being told what to do.
We've got really used to our conveniences, and it's hard to switch from that. But we did exist before those things, too. So I think we'll be okay. Hopefully.
Around the Great Lakes, some environmentalists are concerned about the impact of plastics on wildlife. But in some places, like Michigan and Wisconsin, the backlash against local bans has caused state lawmakers to ban bans altogether. To fight the backlash, Sherry Mason is taking a different approach. She's a professor of chemistry and chair of the Department of Geology and Environmental Sciences at SUNY Fredonia. At a public forum in Buffalo, Mason regales her audience with plastic bag facts. But her outreach goes beyond trying to communicate the scope of the problem.
If we can get people to understand the impact that that plastic bag has, then that can lead to kind of a whole reevaluation of our relationship with this material.
Mason is involved in several studies to try to connect plastic bag use to human health. She says plastic bags break down in the water, become microplastics, and get into our bodies in different ways.
Well, we all use salt, and many of us drink beer, and we all drink drinking water. So we decided to do a study that was focused on those consumable products, and we're finding plastics in all of them.
Plastics can act as a perfect surface for chemicals to hitch a ride on, chemicals that cause problems in human hormone development. The studies are still underway, but Mason says if the plastic is in the water, it's in us. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Veronica Volk in Rochester, New York.
Great Lakes Today is a collaboration of WBFO Buffalo, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI Rochester. A bill aimed at banning plastic bag bans passed in the Pennsylvania House recently. It now moves on to the Senate. The bill was co-sponsored by a Democratic representative from Center County, where plastic bag manufacturer Novolex is located. According to State Impact Pennsylvania, at least four Pennsylvania cities, Philadelphia, York, Erie, and Pittsburgh, want Senate lawmakers to reject the bill, which would prevent municipalities from banning plastic bags or imposing a tax on their use. For more, head to AlleghenyFront.org. About a third of the United States is federally owned, which means it belongs to all of us, the public. But that also gives the president a lot of power over these places. President Trump recently signed an executive order to review all of the national monuments over 100,000 acres designated since Bill Clinton was president.
Today I'm signing a new executive order to end another egregious abuse of federal power and to give that power back to the states and to the people where it belongs.
This week on our podcast, Trump on Earth, the Allegheny Friends Julie Grant takes a closer look at what's at stake for public lands and what we can expect under the new administration. And Julie joins me now. Hey there.
Hi, Kara.
So in response to this executive order, Trump's Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, is in Utah this week visiting national monuments.
Yeah, he's at one called Bear's Ears. It's a 1.35 million acre monument. It's in southeast Utah. It was designated by President Obama just last December. And it includes world-class rock climbing, cliff dwellings, and land that's considered sacred to five Native American tribes.
I've heard a lot about Bear's Ears, and I hear it's beautiful. The Antiquities Act does not give the federal government unlimited power to lock up millions of acres of land and water, and it's time we ended this abusive practice.
President Roosevelt signed the Antiquities Act back in 1906. That's what gave presidents the power to designate federal lands as national monuments, which protects them from commercial development or future mineral exploitation, right?
Right. Even though President Trump is questioning it, the Antiquities Act has been used by many presidents more than 150 times to protect public lands. For our podcast, I spoke with Martin Nye. He's a professor of natural resources policy at the University of Montana. And I asked whether Bear's Ears and another monument Zinke is visiting in Utah, Grand Staircase Escalante, designated by Bill Clinton in 1996, were the reasons for Trump's order to review the national monuments.
Well, I believe so. I mean, Grand Staircase Escalante changed the politics in a big way. You know, these national monument designations have historically been smaller in size, and so that you could protect an archaeological area, an Indian ruin, something of that magnitude. With Grand Staircase Escalante, President Clinton made a landscape-scale proclamation that was larger in size than some national monuments, and the state of Utah was in opposition to it. And so things really became much more politicized after President Clinton's designation. And it, so it has become increasingly controversial. I mean, some Republicans in Congress believe it is gives the president too much authority over these public lands without enough public input and participation in the process. Although that didn't make sense in the case of Bear's Ears, as it included a very participatory process leading up to the proclamation.
And so what do these proclamations mean when an area is designated as a national monument in terms of its resource use? Are we talking about limiting, say, timbering, ranching, oil and gas development?
Well, that's the big one. I mean, all of these proclamations happen on previously existing public lands. So in the case of the Bear's Ears, you have Forest Service and BLM land that is implicated. And with the Antiquities Act, the president will first make clear the purpose of that monument and then provide very site-specific direction on how that place is to be managed in perpetuity. And that can include restrictions on grazing. Often it withdraws energy development and oil and gas development. And it can also have very site-specific provisions like Bear's Ears pertaining to the rights of Native American tribes and co-management and access to cultural resources and reserved rights and so on.
The outdoor industry has also made itself heard out in Utah, withdrawing some major dollars from the state, companies like Patagonia and North Face, because they want the lands protected. Have you ever seen this kind of debate before in the public lands in this kind of way?
I've never seen it at this level in my 20 years of doing this line of work. I mean, there have long been flare-ups and controversies associated to public lands management. I mean, that's the messy part of democracy, but I've never seen it at this level. And professionally, it's hard to keep up. I mean, it's multiple fire hoses, or maybe fire hydrants going off at the same time, and I'm pretty stretched right now to keep up with all of it.
early in the Republican Congress this year, even before the inauguration in January, there was this big legislative push to transfer federal lands to states, you know, say for a dollar or some low amount or something, and give states control over these lands. That met with large-scale opposition. It sounded like, okay, they're not going to do that, but this fight is still out there. Is that right?
You're absolutely right. And there are a number of bills that seek to transfer federal lands to the states or, in fact, privatize those lands. And although there has been an enormous backlash to those proposals, it is still a very real threat and also shows you just how polarized this issue has become. I mean, we have always argued about the best way to manage public lands. Do we need to provide them more environmental protection? How much resource use? That is built into our public land laws. It's a good debate to have, but it is altogether different to be proposing to privatize this public lands legacy of ours.
And what are the big concerns about that? What's wrong with giving states control over these lands? Don't people in the states have a better sense of how those lands are maybe best managed?
Well, there are all sorts of reasons to oppose the transfer. The economics is one of them. There's no way the Western states are going to be able to afford most of these lands. And that's why there is such a reasonable fear that those lands would eventually be privatized. But I want to get back to the first issue you raised and ask your Eastern listeners what they think about federal lands and how often they come west to visit some of our parks here in Montana or some of our wilderness areas. These lands are of national significance. Glacier, Yellowstone, some of our crown jewels, our wilderness areas. These are the values that have been recognized by John Muir and Gifford Pinchot, and all of our conservation icons. State and local governments need to have a large role in determining how those lands are managed. And thankfully, our federal land laws already provide a very privileged position for our state and local governments to participate in those processes. But these lands are national lands, and it is a national public lands legacy.
So this land is your land, this land is my land.
Yeah, and that's Martin Nye, professor of natural resources policy at the University of Montana, talking about public lands on our podcast, Trump on Earth.
Thanks, Julie.
Thanks, Kara.
You can hear more of Julie Grant's conversation with Professor Nye at trumponearth.org. That's where we also have past episodes, and you can subscribe there, too. You can also subscribe to Trump on Earth on iTunes. Thanks for listening to this week's show. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. Our podcast, Trump on Earth, is produced in partnership with Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. More at pointpark.edu.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy. Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation.